From PRI, Public Radio International.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Hannah Arendt's famous phrase, "the banality of evil," will long endure as an apt characterization of the extraordinary cruelty often inflicted by ordinary men. Whether it's the individual act of callous abuse or the monstrous crime of genocide, the capacity for evil bedevils our human race. In this age of extreme violence, the question of evil has even greater urgency, and we must look to the precepts of religion and the findings of science to cast light on our darker side. My guest is Walter Reich, director of the Project on Health, Values, and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Walter, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you very much, George.
Walter, the subject is grim, but I can't imagine a better person to talk about it with. And I thought, as I thought about the topic, that we almost might call this conversation Evil and Everyman, because we're going to talk, I think, about what makes otherwise good people do, obviously, evil things. Let me start by asking you this question, Walter. How important is the sanction of authority, someone on top saying, this is what you can act in this way? How important is that to organizational evil?
It's incredibly important, not only for organizations, but for individuals as well, because it's one of the sanctions that permits people to disengage from the moral precepts that ordinarily govern their behavior. There are probably 7 or 8 or more that one could identify that make it possible for somebody to do something that he or she would normally consider to be an odious act.
Right.
And those mechanisms are what account for much of the ability of people who are proud of their home lives, who have nice families, who are kind to their pets. There's an old grim joke about Hitler having been kind to his dog and a nice vegetarian, but we also know what else Hitler did.
We certainly do. I gather from you, Walter, that one has to use your word, disengage, become, in a sense, another person. Is that it? I mean, you sort of step away from yourself. I mean, what's the precise disengagement here? You're somehow different.
You are in a situation, or put yourself in a situation, that enables you to do something you would ordinarily not do. The issue of self-deception, so that you, in a way, fool yourself about what it is you're doing, is a very complicated one, philosophically problematic, because one of the ways in which one can explain self-deception is, in fact, probably the only way, is to assume there are two people somehow, or two halves. There's a conscious and an unconscious part of a person,
right,
and that one part deceives the other part. Philosophically, it's a problem. How can you say that you don't know what you're doing when you really know what you're doing? And it's not really necessary to get caught up in the conundrums of what has sometimes been called depth psychology to explain these things. There are a number of mechanisms, such as the one you mentioned, appeals to authority. I was just carrying out orders.
Right.
Very famous from the Nuremberg trials. There are several others as well. For example, there is something that has been called cognitive reconstrual, a reconstruction of a situation so that one convinces oneself in some fashion that the people who are being harmed are actually themselves evil and deserve it.
This, Walter, makes me very, very curious about the environment in which it happens, the seedbed, if you will, for this. And the word which comes to my somewhat untutored mind in psychiatry is paranoia. I mean, is there some kind of massive paranoia or other way of looking at things that a society has to be in for this to be operative? I mean, does there have to be sort of a massive fear for these kinds of things to become?
Well, there are certainly circumstances that abet processes like this taking place. They don't all occur in all of the places where such things take place. Certainly, if people are experiencing hardship, if times are not good, there's a greater likelihood of a populace trying to identify the cause of their misfortune. If things are rough in whether it's Weimar Germany or contemporary Russia, it increases the likelihood that anti-democratic and fascist forces will be embraced that identify a particular cause, a group or a force or a power or foreign elements or something that is the cause of the misfortune that the people are feeling or experiencing, and that they should in some way resist, fight against, or in some way get rid of.
Yeah. So it's this climate that allows the demagogue to do his work.
It's like a fertilizer. It enables the demagogue to flourish.
I'd love to hear you comment on this aspect of it, Walter, as a psychiatrist, because one of the most frightening things about this entire phenomenon is that it can take place in a society that is in sort of a third world state, as we've seen in Rwanda, mm-hmm. but it can also take place, as we've also seen, in the most sophisticated of societies.
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's kind of astounding in a way.
Right. It is astounding, and one of the reasons that the Holocaust was so very astounding, of course, was that it took place in the heart of Europe, within a society that was, in many respects, in music certainly, in literature, in art, among the most civilized, by usual definitions of that term, in the world, maybe the most civilized in some fashion. And yet, it didn't take much to, or it didn't seem to take all that much, to get that society to focus itself into a kind of ferocious act of evil.
One aspect of it about Nazi Germany that appalls and intrigues is this. The people who were persecuted, were executed, were the neighbors of the people who did it.
Mm-hmm.
It was that close.
Right.
And in addition to the phenomena which you presented to us of this distancing of those who do it, I want to ask you about the indifference of others. I mean, the almost conscious turning away. Is this not also an aider and a better, if you will, of,
yes.
of the process?
Yeah, I recently there have come to there be some distinctions made among various groups who are involved in that particular process of genocide, the Holocaust, in which some people were simply called the perpetrators, namely the killers. Then there are the victims, and we know who they were, the victims of the Holocaust, and the bystanders, the people who didn't actively kill, but who, and didn't even turn anybody in, because then they would be part of the perpetrator community, if you will, although that happened too, and happened very frequently in Germany and elsewhere. It happened among non-Germans, it happened among the populations that were occupied by Germany, where there were Jews, and where the populations, some persons in those populations, were delighted to get rid of the Jews and would find them if they were in hiding and tell the German authorities where they were so that they could be rousted out, killed, or sent to camps. This occurred in Poland. It occurred in the Baltic states. It occurred in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It occurred in Germany. And it tended to be harder if somebody knew someone. But generally the explanation was we didn't know, or this was what the authorities were doing.
Let's examine that, probe that a bit, because we've had now a half century, and therefore the ability with hindsight to evaluate the accounts of people, perpetrators, to be blunt, who did do this. Right. What do they say, and how do you analyze it as a psychiatrist? I mean, there were battalions formed, for example, of sort of village policemen who would literally take their neighbors out and slaughter them, and then went on to the most prosaic of post-war existences.
Right.
Is there some generic way they came to grips with this, or would explain it to themselves and to others when they were faced with it?
Well, there was a very... I hate to use this term, but a very interesting... I have trouble using that word in connection with the subject, but a very interesting, very compelling, illuminating study of a particular battalion, Battalion 101 of the German Water Police. And there's some notion, some image that what happened in the Holocaust was that somehow it was SS officers, special group of evil men, almost as if they had a big E on their foreheads, walking around saying, "We're evil." Nobody believes they're evil. That's something I want to get back to also. Nobody thinks of himself as evil. And you need all kinds of mechanisms to convince yourself that, in fact, you're not evil. Hitler didn't think of himself as evil. Or Stalin, who was responsible for many millions of deaths. But these were people, this battalion of water police, and there were many battalions of water police, who were not SS officers, who before the war were bookkeepers, pharmacists. They got into these water police battalions. They were put into them because they were too old for the regular army. Some of them were police officers in various towns. And they were sent into Poland. And this particular battalion, 101, consisted of about 500 men who were in their 30s, 40s, a few in their 50s, who during the couple of years that they were in Poland were responsible for the deaths of 83,000 Jews.
These 500 men killed 83,000 people.
Right. They did it either directly, I think there were something like 40-some-odd thousand that they shot in the head, or in the neck, to be precise, and 30-some-odd thousand whom they stuffed into railroad cars that ultimately ended up in death camps where these people were gassed. And what's really striking about the study, which was based on documents that the author, Christopher Browning, found in Cologne, I believe, from the trial of a few of them, was that at first they found it unpleasant, even odious. Most of them, after the war, when they went on trial, claimed they were among the non-shooters when they would round up the Jews in various towns and shoot them in the back of the neck. They would take them one by one into the woods and just shoot them. And there were gory descriptions of these people coming back from the police officers coming back with pieces of the brains and skulls of these Jews on their clothing, and some of them got sick. Gradually, they got used to it. Probably many more claimed not to have shot than actually didn't shoot.
Walter, you know what I want to do with this particular example in mind is turn in a moment to something that you prefaced it with, the fact that no one wants to consider themselves evil, and talk about individual motivation. Before that, though, let me just take a moment away just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Walter Reich, Director of the Project on Health, Values, and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Walter Reich is also a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine, professor of psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, and contributing editor of the Wilson Quarterly. Walter, I want to turn, as I said, to this question, the individual aspect of this, the fact that people do evil and yet cannot admit themselves to themselves that they are doing it. How do you explain that as a psychiatrist? I mean, why does that happen?
Well, first of all, let me try to define what I mean by evil. I remember participating in a conference focusing on the Holocaust and individual motivations at one point, and nobody used the word evil. Everybody was an academic, historians, sociologists, social scientists, and I happened to be the commentator for that session. And I said, you know, I think we can't help but use the word evil. And one of the panel members was himself a Holocaust survivor and an historian, said, well, you know, it's usually seen as a theological word, and therefore we don't use it. But we use it in everyday life, and I don't necessarily define it in theological terms. I define it in practical terms, and my definition has something to do with an act or a process, the result of which is the deliberate bringing of harm to other persons who are innocent of any intent to bring oneself harm. I wanted to read something to you, if I may, because I just came across it today. I was looking at a book by Fred Katz called Ordinary People and Extraordinary Evil, which was published last year. And he uses on his in the beginning of his book two quotations that I think really are valuable in connection with what we're discussing. One is from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who, of course, is the great chronicler of the Soviet Gulag, the system of prisoner camps under Stalin. And in the Gulag Archipelago, he writes, if only there were evil people somewhere, insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? And the second quotation is from Primo Levi, who was an Italian chemist who recently, just a few years ago, committed suicide, who in a way was one of the chroniclers of Auschwitz, a Jew who was incarcerated and survived Auschwitz and wrote several books on his experiences. And this is from one book called Survival in Auschwitz. He writes, monsters exist, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the common man, the functionaries, ready to believe and to act without asking questions.
Walter, we come to a key moment in our conversation, because having begun correctly with a look at the Holocaust and the motive forces of individuals there, coming now with your very helpful, I think, definition of evil and the use of the theological term, and with the power of these quotations, what I mean by the discomfort of the moment is that we're powerfully reminded that this is the capacity we all have. I mean, one cannot say, and I take the eloquence of those words to further mean that there is some separate group of people out there constituted to do these acts, but that we are all capable of them.
We are, to a greater or lesser extent, capable of doing them. Obviously, there are some people who are more capable than other people. Exactly why is something one could talk about and try to figure out, but the basic mechanisms that enable us to do bad things to other people apply in most cases, I think, of doing evil. We talked already about looking at a situation and that people to whom we want to bring harm as being bad themselves, that we have to do it, blaming them for having hurt us, that it's a social benefit to get rid of them or to hurt them. Another mechanism has been called euphemistic labeling, in which one doesn't talk about what one is doing in its real terms, in real descriptions. One uses euphemisms.
Which are kind of a code to cover up what the real purpose is.
Well, for example, in Auschwitz, bodies were called logs sometimes. So the order would be given to get rid of the logs. There's another mechanism that one can call displacement of responsibility, which we referred to before in terms of referring to authority, saying, just following orders. It's not my responsibility, it's somebody else's. There's also something that has been referred to as diffusion of responsibility. If you create a bureaucratic process in which everybody only has a small role, then nobody has to feel that they are personally responsible for the whole thing.
The process did it.
The process did it. Auschwitz did it. Mm. Of course, there were individual acts in which people shot other people, or people dumped pellets of poison gas into the gas chambers, and in the end, they knew they were killing, and they used other mechanisms to justify that.
Right.
There is also a mechanism of distortion of consequences, that is, convincing oneself that one isn't really hurting or damaging or bringing harm to somebody. For example, the idea of dropping a bomb on people who are thousands of feet below is easier than shooting a person in the neck.
Because it's anonymous.
Because it's anonymous. You don't see the faces. The famous experiments by Stanley Milgram at Yale, in which he had subjects who were applying electric current, they thought, or they were told, to other people in another room who would then scream in pain, and they would be encouraged to apply more and more current. That mechanism probably explains or helps explain much of why some of them quit, but many of them kept on applying more and more current, or thinking that they, of course, nobody actually got shocked in this experiment. It's an experiment that probably could not be done now, under the rules of that governed ethical research.
But they would increase the voltage.
They would increase the voltage. People would scream. They would be told, the others would be told, you got to scream louder now. And they would be told things like, well, you're not really hurting him.
Hmm.
And they would seize upon that as a justification for being able to do it, even though many of them became extremely uncomfortable.
Walter, our subject has no conclusion, unfortunately. And just as unfortunately, or almost as unfortunately, our conversation has. So let me ask you this. What, and here's just, it's a vast question, I know, but given not just your knowledge as a psychiatrist, but your moral concern and your ability and your willingness to use theological precepts, how does a society like ours build barriers against this happening? I mean, are there steps that you take or that you're conscious of in terms of things perhaps like human rights, I don't know, but that will make this less likely rather than more likely to occur?
Well, you know, I'm a child of what I consider or hope to be an age of reason. Maybe it's a self-deceptive fantasy, to use a word I declined to use earlier, self-deception. I have the belief that we can learn from experience. Not that it obviates all future similar experience, but that having experience something terrible, we can learn from it about ourselves and about our societies. And one of the reasons I feel we're extremely fortunate in having in our midst here in Washington, but also in our midst in America, this new museum, the Holocaust Museum, is that we decided as a country to give a place for an institution that dealt with something very terrible, but that by its very existence, through its permanent exhibit and through its programs and through its research, shows us what human beings are capable of. And we won't all draw the same lessons from it, but I think we, in general, will conclude that human beings are capable of the most terrible things. And they're capable of those things as a result of the mechanisms that we were talking about. And we have to watch what we do and how we think and recognize in ourselves and in our societies inclinations and processes that can result in these kinds of terrible acts that we're referring to as evil. And I want to just stress one more thing. The museum, in its early section, in its permanent exhibit, focuses on, and rightfully, the dissolution of democratic institutions in Nazi Germany and the subsequent processes that resulted in the Holocaust. I think there's a very powerful cautionary tale that's particularly compelling and resonant for Americans, because Americans visit this city of Washington and go to the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Memorial, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, and often don't really appreciate what we have here, don't really understand that democracy is what stands between them and terrible things. And I think institutions like the Holocaust Museum can help orient a visitor to Washington so that he or she understands what the value of democracy is and that we shouldn't take these things for granted.
Very, very well said, Dr. Reich. Walter, thank you for being a guest on Dialogue.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Walter Reich, director of the Project on Health, Values, and Public Policy at the Woodrow Wilson Center. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassette copies or more information on Dialogue, call the radio store through your international operator at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. Contact us on the internet at radiodial@americaonline.com. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.